connected to this week's parasha. Usually, Tazria and Metzora are together. This year, because it's an extra month, so Tazria and Metzora are separate. But really, the subject matter, Tazria begins the first eight psukim talking about a woman giving birth. But after that, it talks about the malady of Tzaras. Tzaras is translated to mean leprosy, but Tzaras is not leprosy. Leprosy is a skin disease which is extremely catchy, and it's not curable. Well, they used to have leper colonies where they would send these people away, but it's not curable, and it's very catchy, and it doesn't exist. And Tzaras is not catchy, because one person has Tzaras doesn't mean the other one's going to get it. And on top of that, it's not cured by medicine. Actually, the person has to do tshuva, and the Kohen comes to look at it, and every couple of days, and every day actually, and after 7 days, the person can become tahar. So there's not really actually any medicine, but it's a physical disease that comes out of a spiritual disease. Which, by the way, every physical disease, everyone thinks that your guf controls your nefesh, but that's not true. Your nefesh controls your guf. In the times of the Arizal, if somebody would get sick, let's say they would have an eye infection, their eye is all infected and it's red and it's pussy, they would go to that Arizal, and the Arizal would say, it's your right eye represents what, your body, your physical body is 613 avarim, limbs, veins, pieces, parts. Your spiritual neshama also has 613 parts. And everything in your physical, in your spiritual neshama affects your guf. So if there's something wrong in your body, it's because there's something wrong in your neshama. So the Arizal was able to hear from the person what was bothering them physically, and he would know what your left ear, your right eye, your left eye, what mitzvah all those organs are connected to. And therefore, if someone's left kidney was bothering him, he would know what mitzvah you're not keeping or what mitzvah you need to fix. And if you would fix that mitzvah, then all of a sudden the pain that you're having would go away. He would fix the part in your neshama, and automatically that would fix the part in your guf. And there's many different stories of great rabbis that saw certain blemishes on people and certain scars on people and certain things on people and whatever it is. And they would know just by looking at these things what that person did, what sin they did. Because the physical body is a representation of what happens in the guf. So tzaras, leprosy, if you speak Lashon Hara, right? So that is a certain spiritual disease that you have. I heard this week, I was preparing to give a shir on Shabbos to a bunch of women, and I was sitting in the other room and there was a woman giving a shir before me. An older lady, a Rebbetzin from Europe, she was giving a shir, and I was listening while I was preparing, I was listening to her shir. And she said something amazing. She said, when she was a little girl in Europe, she came home and she was telling her sister Lashon Hara about a girl in her class. She was all of 9 years old. She came home and she was telling her sister about another girl in her class, something very bad. And her father overheard it. So her father turned around, her name was Miril, whatever. And he said, Miril, instead of saying, Miril, why are you talking Lashon Hara about this girl? He said, Miril, what's bothering you? What's wrong with you? In other words, if you're talking Lashon Hara about someone else, it's not about the other person. It means there's a problem with you. So her father was smart enough not to say, why are you talking bad about this girl? But to say, what's wrong with you? Because if you're talking bad about someone else, it's to make you feel good, and there's something missing in you. So tzaras comes to a person, the tzaras comes to a person when you talk bad about other people, so there's a spiritual problem in you, and that comes out physically with these white spots on your skin, or on your house, or on your clothing, right? It starts on your house. Hashem first punishes us with our things that are far away, nechasim, houses. He takes away our money, and if we still don't get the hint that there's something wrong, then it gets much closer to you. He takes away things that are closer to you. And then if you still don't get it, and you still don't do tshuva, then the tzaras comes on your body itself. He doesn't start punishing a person with yisurim with pain on their body. He starts with objects. He takes away these objects. And if you don't wake up, then it ends up affecting the person themselves. So, there's a very interesting pasuk, a very important pasuk in last week's parasha, when it begins to talk about the whole thing of tzaras. And it says stepped on the wire. Sorry. Technical difficulties. Hold on. Yeah, just plug it in. We'll see what happens. Ooh, no good. Wrong one. Okay. No.
Oh, no.
No, three has something. Testing.
Totally off.
Testing. Okay, thank you. We still need men. Okay. Anyway. There was a plug. So the Pasuk says the following. V'ro'a kayin es hanega. And the kayin saw the disease. V'or ha-basar, in the skin of the meat of the person. V'se'a b'nega hofech lavan. And the hair in that area that the nega is, that the disease is, turned white. Umara ha-nega amag ma'or b'saro. And the white on the skin looks three-dimensional, looks deeper. When you look at it, it looks like it's deeper than the rest of the skin around it. Nega tzaras, that's tzaras. V'ro'a kayin, and the kayin will see it. V'timei oisoi, and he will make it tamei. So the question is like this. The pasuk began, V'ro'a ha-kayin es ha-nega, and the kayin saw the disease. And it describes what he saw. And then the pasuk ends, V'ro'a ha-kayin v'timei oisoi, and the kayin saw it, and he made it tamei. You already said he saw it. The pasuk begins saying, V'ro'a ha-kayin es ha-nega, and the kayin saw the disease. So why are you ending up the pasuk with saying, V'ro'a ha-kayin, and the kayin saw it, v'timei oisoi, and he made it tamei? You already said he saw it. So why are you ending the pasuk and saying he saw it? So there's a beautiful chazal on this, which is very important in life. And that is that a Jew, even a kayin, even someone comes to him and he has tzaras, a Jew has no right to make another Jew tamei unless he looks twice. In other words, the kohen, the first time he looks at this person and he sees a tzaras, he has no right to say tamei. Look again. Maybe you didn't see it right. Before you make another Jew tamei, before you throw a kid out of school, before you call a girl or a boy at risk, before you make a judgment on another human being, says the Torah, before you make someone tamei, before you make another Jew no good, you better look twice. And that's why only after the second v'ra'ahu does the Torah say v'timei oisa, you make him tamei. Not only that, not only you have to look twice before you make someone else tamei, but there's a special halacha that if a man comes to the kohen or a woman and has tzaras, and he looks at it, and there's no question, he looks at it twice, and there's no question that it's tzaras, but that person happens to be in Sheva Brachas, they just got married, this guy just got married, and he's in the middle of Sheva Brachas, the halacha is that the kohen has to say tahar, even though it's 100% tamei. He has to say tahar, because he cannot make a chasen tamei, because that means he has to be chutz lamachaneh, and he can't be with his wife, and she just got married, and it would be terrorizing to take this chasen away, put him outside the machaneh, she just got married. So even though the kohen knows he's tamei, he has to say tahar, because they're in the middle of Sheva Brachas. Which means that not only does the kohen have to look twice, but he has to know the situation that the person is in. There's a story with Rav Shach, very famous story of Rav Shach. Rav Shach was tough. Was a big tzaddik, a big gadol. And these two Rosh Hashivas came to him and they said to Rav Shach that this boy is totally out of control. He's ruining all the kids in yeshiva and we're going to throw him out. And we just came to Rav Shach to, you know, to get your haskama before we do this. So Rav Shach said, do you know his parents? Do you know the boy's parents? They said, not really. I mean, they came in to register him, but we don't really. He said, did you ever go to their house to see the family? They said, no. He screamed, Rishayim! To these Rosh Hashivas, Rishayim! Get out of my house and don't ever come back. How dare you judge a young boy and throw him out of yeshiva? You didn't even go to see his situation. You didn't go to his house. You didn't go to see his family. And they say in the story that after they researched the family, it was talking about a very dysfunctional family. And had they known that, they would have never thought of throwing him out. But they didn't care. They never checked it out. So we learn from this pasuk that before you make a decision on a kid, before you make a decision on a friend, before you make a decision on any Jew, you got to look twice. Not only you got to look twice, but you got to know their whole life situation before you can make such a judgment. And this we learn out from tzaras. Not only that, a very interesting thing about the kahanim, the halacha of tzaras, so it can happen on your house first. So also you can have this wool and have a fungus sort of growing that's white, right? And that's tzaras. And the kohen, before he would go and look at the tzaras, right? If he would think there for 1 second from hearing them describing that it's Saras, he would tell them, take everything out of your house. Take everything, all your clothing and all the kalim, get everything out of the house, and then I'm going to go check. Why? Because once he makes the house tameh, everything in it is tameh. So it's not just, you're tameh, you're no good, throw them out. He had to think, if I'm going to make them tameh, and everything in the house is going to become tameh, you're not going to be able to use anything. So let's clean everything out of the house first, and then we'll check it. A person can't judge other Jews just, you know, this kid's at risk, this kid's no good, throwing this one out, I'm throwing that one out, I don't want this one in my shul. Before you do such a thing, you better be very sure. And therefore, the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, "Al tadnes chavercha at shegielim komo." You're not allowed to judge another Jew, chavercha, right? Is another Jew until you're in their place. And everyone here, I'm sure, has learned physics, and we know that no two objects occupy the same space. First thing you learn in physics, I'm not brilliant, but I learned that. Two objects cannot occupy the same space. Therefore, what the Mishnah is telling us is Al Tadnas Chavercha Chagimum Komo, you can't judge your friend until you're in his place. But in this world, you can't be in his place. So what is the Mishnah telling us in a nice way? That you can't judge another Jew. It's not for you to judge, it's for Hashem to judge. Sometimes girls, you know, I send them to school and this and whatnot, and I help them, and they fall, and they're like, I can't talk to Rabbi Alston anymore because he's going to think that I'm who knows what. And I say to them, I'm not here to judge you. Halavai, I would be your judge. You could pay off. Me, you could smile at. God's your judge. You're his daughter, so maybe he'll have a lot of rachamim on you. But we're not here to judge any other person. That's Hashem's job. That's a tough job, judging a person. Only God can judge a person. That's not our job. And that's what this pasuk is telling us. I want to tell you an amazing story that a rabbi told me. Just to give you an example of such a story. So there's some Syrian girls here, I'm sure, and some Sephardic girls. Now Sephardic rabbis, right? They're fantastic, right? Kvod Harav, they're fantastic. But they're tough. They're tough. It's, you know, my way or the highway. It's not like the Ashkenazi guys, you know. They're tough. And they're very strict about what goes on in Bet Knesset. And we'll talk a little bit like Rabbi Eli Monsel for 2 minutes. Right? There's Kvod Harav, Kvod HaTorah, right? And they're very tough about that. And I just davened in a Syrian shul 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago when we were by the carries for Friday night. So, Baruch Hashem, I had davened mincha already. I davened mincha Friday afternoon. I don't wait till Friday night because you know usually you're late, this and that. So I davened at 1:30 in the afternoon. So I came to shul, and the Syrians davened very early. They davened very early mincha and ma'ariv. Then they finish ma'ariv, and then they learn for an hour before they come home. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. It's amazing. But they're very strict about not coming late. You can't just walk into shul whenever you feel like walking in the middle of Kriya Shema, in the middle of Chadoide, you know, First of all, the rabbi, right, the rabbi faces the door where you come in, number one, in all their shuls. That chair is always facing the Baron HaKodesh, and he faces, so he sees everybody that comes in. And there were guys, when I came, that were very late, and they said they're not going in, they're making a minyan outside. There's no way they're walking in late into shul. This rabbi, you don't do that. Because you're teaching everybody you can walk into shul anytime you want. No, you can't walk into shul anytime you want. There's a minyan, there's a time, there's a set time. It's not a free-for-all. So that's very beautiful, because whatever. Some of the shuls I daven in, you come whenever you feel like coming, and nobody says anything. This rabbi, You come, you better be there on time. You got like a 4-6 minute, you know, thing over there that you can come, but after that, so this rabbi is sitting there in a Syrian shul, and in walks this man by Kriya Shema in Arvis L'Shabbos, missed L'Chadaydi, missed all the Mizmors, missed Mincha. The guy comes walking into shul. Now in the back of the shul were like folding chairs that the kids were all over, and you know, so that some of them were facing that way, some of them were facing that way, some of them were facing this way. They were all over the place. This guy, the rabbi sees this man walks in, sits, goes to the first chair, sits down, and faces the opposite direction of the Aron HaKodesh. Faces the back. His back is to the rabbi, his back is to the Torah. You don't do that in shul. You don't come into a shul and put your back facing the Aron HaKodesh. So here's this rabbi sitting there, and he's a tough guy. And he runs his shul the right way. And he sees this man, chutzpah, first of all, to walk in by Kriya Shema, it's almost over davening. And then you walk in late to my shul, and on top of that, you sit with your back to me and then back to the Aron HaKodesh. So he's done this, Rabbi. He can't daven anymore. Because he's so steaming inside that this man did this. And he's thinking how he's going to rip this guy's head off and tell him that he better never come to his shul again. And this is not free for all and do whatever you want. And he can't daven anymore. He's done. He's so upset at this person. So he finishes davening. He makes up his mind that the minute he finishes davening, what is he going to do? He's going to go over to this man and tell him, this is a shul, this kavod ha-torah, kvod harav, kvod beit ha-knesset. You don't do this in my shul. Don't ever come back here. Right? So he finishes Shai HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He finishes the leno, they finish kaddish, and he's about to go rip this guy's head off. And one of the people in the shul runs up to him and says, Rabbi, I got to ask you a question. I have to run home, but I got to ask you a question. His wife forgot to put, I don't know what she forgot to put on, whatever, it was a shayla on Shabbos. And meanwhile, he's looking at this guy because he don't want to lose him. He wants to get him and tell him, you don't do this in my shul. Right? So he's like, okay, he's not really answering the guy. He's looking at this guy. He's watching this guy because he doesn't want him to leave and get away. His rabbi told me over the story. Listen to this. So this man in the back, who's facing the back, gets up. And he takes out of his pocket this thing, and he begins to open it up. Open it up, open it up, open it up. Right? And it's a cane. And he takes the cane, and he starts tapping. He was blind. So he came to shul very late because he couldn't find shul. And the first seat he got to, he sat in, happened to have been facing away. And here's this rabbi who has all this fire inside. He wants to rip this guy's head off. And he says, Hashem Yisborach, thank you, you saved my life. Could you imagine he would have ran to the blind man and started screaming at him, don't ever come back to my shul? So Hashem, for whatever reason, he must have had tzchusim that this guy came to ask a question, then he had a chance to watch this man take out this cane. Don't judge another Jew until you look twice, three times, four times, five times, until you know. Look what kind of mistake, chas v'shalom, with this rabbi. He missed his whole davening. He would have understood that this man was blind when he walked in, right? So this man was smart enough that he walked into shul. He didn't want anyone to know, so he folded and put it in his pocket. But imagine if he would have known he was blind, he would have ran back there, he would have turned the chair around, he would have sat him down, he would have brought him to the front, he would have invited him to his house, he would have walked him home, it would have been a whole different davening. We have a blind man davening in our shul. Amazing! Instead, he sat there, and the rabbi missed the whole davening. Because from Kriyat Shema, he was so on fire, he couldn't daven anymore. We have to be very careful before we judge another Jew. And that's what the Torah tells us. The Torah says, you have to look twice before you say someone's tummy. It's an amazing, amazing story. But tonight, we're going to have a lot of amazing stories. Okay. Before I get to Pesach, I'm not going to keep you here all night, just another 35 minutes. Before I get to Pesach, there's something I want to talk about, a totally different subject. But next week in Mitzvah Hashem, I'll connect Mitzvah Hashem Wednesday. I don't know if you can get away Wednesday before Pesach, you know, to come to a shir. But next week, we're going to put all the shirim together, and I'm going to explain to you this idea that I'm thinking about, what it has to do with Pesach. So I'm dealing with a lot of kids that have drug problems and other types of problems. And been thinking about this for a long time, and Baruch Hashem, finally, this week, preparing for my shir, it all came together. And I find that many kids who go to rehab, and many people who go to rehab, whether it's for gambling or drinking or drugs or other things, they do well for a short amount of time, and then they relapse. And if you look into the history of rehab, you'll find that the numbers are 80% of people who go to rehab relapse. There's a place in California for all the actors and actresses, which is supposed to be the best place in the world, and they're proud to tell the world for $45,000 for a month, right? Their average is 60% relapse. And the question is why? And it's a very important question. And I'll tell you the answer. If you look at your hand, you'll see that on your hand there are many lines. And they got these palm readers, and right? The question is, why did Hashem do this? Everything has a reason, right? He scribbles, he has etch-a-sketch, he scribbles, he wants to write, you know, lines on your hand. Not only do you have lines on your hand, but if you were to take a pen and circle some of those lines, and look at them in a month from now, you'll see that they grew to the left, to the right, up, down. I've been watching some lines on my hands for the last 2 years, and it's very interesting how they grow and where they go. And the question that always bothered me, because I like to think out of the box, is God doesn't do anything for no reason. Why did he put lines on my hands? Now, we're not supposed to go to palm readers, so he didn't put on lines on my hand to go to a palm reader, because I'm not supposed to go to a palm reader. So why did Hashem put lines on our hands? And the answer is that the lines in our hands are a consequence. Because, like I started the share tonight, everything on the person's physical body, right, comes out, everything on a person's spiritual soul comes out on your physical body, which means that if you have lines on your hands, you have lines on your soul. Now, why are there lines in your soul? So I'm going to tell you why there are lines in your soul. Another thing that always bothered me is this avera gereres avera. If you do an avera, right, it causes you to do another avera. That's not fair. That's not fair. If I do this avera, a person's machal Shabbos, so because I'm machal Shabbos, now I'm going to eat lobster? That's not fair. So what is this avera gereres avera? So it's wrong. That's not what it means. Avera gereres avera means that the avera you do will cause you to do it again. 80% relapse. 60% relapse. It's not another avera. Avera gereres avera. The avera that you're doing now is going to cause you to do the avera again. Why? Because of the lines on your palm. Because every time you do something wrong, what you do is you open up a road. Every person's neshama has a road map. And you open up a road. And I'm going to explain to you what I'm saying. For instance, Rabbi Wallerstein loves chocolate. We talk about this all the time. Now, if I want to go on a diet, and I open the refrigerator, and there's chocolate pudding in the refrigerator, it's a struggle. It's a struggle. And most of the time, it's strong enough to say no. My daughter, who never ate pudding in her life, opens up the refrigerator and doesn't even see that the pudding's there. She looks right past the pudding, to the jello, to the cake, to whatever she's looking at. She doesn't even see the pudding. You know why? Because she never ate chocolate pudding. So she doesn't know what it tastes like. So that road of chocolate pudding, I'm just giving an example, does not exist in her life. Therefore, that road doesn't exist. You can't go down a road that doesn't exist. For Rabbi Wallerstein, I'm just giving a very easy marshal. Rabbi Wallerstein, who has the road of chocolate pudding because he's eating it his whole life, and his grandmother made it and he loved it, and his mother made it and he loved it. So it's part of the road map in his neshama, in his body, right? And maybe even became a taiva that he really likes it. It's really like important in his life, right? So Rabbi Wallerstein, he's on a diet. So what does Rabbi Wallerstein do not to eat the chocolate pudding? He puts up a sign, road closed. Road closed. It's there, but I'm not going there. And he puts a bunch of these orange little things like you have on a road, and he puts it in front of there, and he puts a big little piece of wood across, and it says road closed, and he walks by. But I got to walk by, I got to look at it, because it's a road in my life. Now, you're on that diet, you're doing very well, and you just got a phone call, and you're under a lot of pressure, and you're a little bit dizzy because you didn't have enough sugar in your system, and you're depressed, and you're upset, and something just happened, and you open that refrigerator, and that chocolate pudding's there, and you're like, big deal, so I'm going to take one spoon, what's going to be the end of it? So let's move the cones. Move that cone, and move that cone, take the piece of wood. I did it in Lakewood on Monday. I had to go see someone, and they were, the place that I had to go see was on a road, and the road was closed for construction. And they told me, when you get there, don't worry, because you can't really get around. Just move the cones, move the wood, pull in, put them back, and go down the road, and we're on the right-hand side. And that's what I did. It was very easy. But if there was no road, I couldn't go down that road. It doesn't exist. So when you're doing avera, you create a road. When a person said, the Yetzer Hara says, it's just once. You're just taking one drink. You're just smoking one cigarette. It's one joint. It's just one boy. It's one time going on the internet. What's it going to do to you? You know what it does to you? You just made a new road. And now it's in your system, because now you know what a drink tastes like. And you know what it does to you. And you know what a joint tastes, on a cigarette, or a boy, whatever it is that you're getting involved in, that one time, now you got a road. Now you want to do tshuva, you can't get rid of the road. You got to put up a block and say, do not enter. So how come rehab doesn't work most of the time? Because when you go to rehab, and I have a bunch of boys that I'm dealing with right now, it's really not their fault. They had backaches. they had broken bones, whatever it was, they were in pain, and the doctor gave them Oxycontin, and the doctor gave them Vicodin, and the doctor gave them Tylenol 2 with codeine, and they took these pills to get rid of their pain. But there's a road now in this guy's system, program, that says Vicodin takes away pain. So the next time he's in pain, what does he reach for? A bottle of Vicodin. And then he becomes an addict. The dealers in drugs in America or anywhere, what they do is they give the kids free drugs. Free, the first time they go around the public schools. And that's why there's a special law in America that if a drug dealer is caught within a certain amount of distance from a school, they throw the key away. That guy's gone. Because what they do is they give the kids drugs just once for free. But once the kid does the drug, now it's in their system. Once it's in their system, so you go to rehab, and rehab cleans you and detoxes you, and you're in this beautiful place, and you're in AA and NA and BA and ZA, and you're talking to everybody, and everyone's part of your group, and everything's beautiful, and everyone has the same problem, and you feel at home, and everything's good, and you're doing well. So why are you relapsing after 7 years? Why is my friend who didn't smoke for 7.5 years started 2 months ago smoking again? He beat it. The road was closed for 7.5 years, but he said, I lost my business. I was having shalom bias problems. Where was I supposed to go, Rabbi Wallerstein? So I started smoking again. But if you never smoked in your life, that road doesn't exist. So you can't go back to smoking. I never smoked a cigarette in my life. So no matter how depressed I'm going to get, that is not where I'm going. I might go to Chas V'Shalom Goyish or rock and roll. I might start listening to Led Zeppelin again because as a kid, that's what I was listening to. So that road is closed, but it's there. That road is there. Just happened to me a few weeks ago. I was in CVS and they were playing a song from my old days. And yeah. I'm walking down the aisle and Rabbi Wallerstein is not realizing subconsciously, I'm singing it to myself. And all of a sudden I said to myself, oh my God, if there's going to be someone listening to me sing Stairway to Heaven in the middle of CVS, they're going to say, Rabbi Wallerstein, I thought, Goyish music, you know, hello? I didn't even realize I was singing it. They were playing it, so I was singing it because even though that road was closed, but the road exists because I listened to it as a kid. So therefore, Avera Gerasa Vera means that you're creating new roads in your life. And those new roads exist even though it says road closed. But it's a behavior that you learned. There's someone that I'm very close to who's into all natural healing. And he's been making me crazy for the last 5 years. He stretches me, he breaks my bones, you can hear me screaming across the world. They're into this whole natural thing, you know. The bottom of your feet, they take away your heartburn, they take away your headaches, it's amazing. It's really weird, it's crazy. I was sitting there like, I don't believe in this. And I had heartburn, and he says, okay, give me 2 seconds. I said, well, you got Alka-Seltzer? He goes, no. He starts pressuring the bottom of my foot. I feel my stomach bubbling, and like 5 minutes later, he says, yeah, we do this. The first thing you learn, we do this for pregnant women, because they have heartburn a lot. The first thing you learn in this pressure point on the feet is how to get rid of heartburn. And like, it's amazing, right? Guess what? When I have heartburn, you think I call him to rub my feet? I pop an Alka-Seltzer. I pop a Rolaids. Because that's what I learned as a kid. You have heartburn, you pop a Rolaids. I pop a Tylenol when I have a headache. His kids eat ginger roots and licorice roots and I don't know what, and never took antibiotics in their life, and never took an aspirin in their life, and they're healthy. But I'm not reaching for ginger roots. Because as a kid, I reached for Tylenol. My mother gave me Tylenol. So it's a learned behavior. So even when you try to stop, Lamaister, when you're that kid who comes out of rehab, and life is good, he's good. But the minute the pressure happens, what does he reach for? He reaches for the Vicodin. Because that road exists, and it's very easy to move the cones. You can't create a new road, but it's very easy to move the cones. And this is in everything in life. And therefore, Avera Gerasa Avera, when you do something like that, you're causing a road. Now, you're going to say, okay, Sarah Wallerstein, that's it. I'm done because I did bad things. No. You got to put a lot of blocks up. You can't just put a piece of wood with 3 cones. You got to put concrete bunkers that tanks can't get through. You got to protect yourself. So when Rabbi Wallerstein's on a diet, he tells his wife, whatever you do, no chocolate pudding in the fridge. Because I don't want to have to go to that fridge at 2 o'clock at night and get into a whole war. Should I move the cone? Shouldn't I move the cone? It shouldn't be there. It doesn't have to be there. So we have to protect ourselves. But Lemaisa, when a person does something, you have to understand that Yetzer Hara, he's fooling you. He's telling you one time won't make a difference. Baruch Hashem, I don't drink. And people ask me all the time, Rabbi Wallerstein, I'm Purim. Get drunk. One girl wrote me, I'm Purim, are you getting drunk? I want to see you drunk. Thank you very much. I'm very excited about that. Thank you. You want to see me drunk. I want to see you lose it. I want to see you out of control. I want to see who you are. And my Talmidim say, Rebbe, it's a mitzvah on Purim, drink. And I'm like, no, I do the sleeping thing. Go to sleep for an hour. I don't know the difference between Haman and Mordechai. I don't know the difference between anything when I'm sleeping. And that's what I do. Why don't I drink? It's very simple, because I know I might enjoy it. Tell you the truth. What happens if I drink and I get all buzzed and I get all happy, right? Wow. And then in 5 years from now, I'm going through a very hard time. I'm going to reach, Chas V'Shalom, I'm going to reach for that buzz. Because I had such a buzz. As long as I don't have it, I'm not interested in drinking. Because what is drinking? I don't know. Because I don't have that road. What is smoking pot? I don't know. Baruch Hashem, I never smoked it. If I smoked it and stuff was bad, maybe I'd go there. Maybe I'd move the cones. And therefore, the Yetzirah, when he tells you to do something once, and it's not a big deal, it's a very big deal, because you paved a new road. Perfect example. I'll show you what I'm talking about. Whatever's in the physical world is in the spiritual world. Perfect example, I'll show you. Take a piece of paper. Okay, this paper has never been ripped. Right? It's a clean piece of paper. It's never been ripped. So Rabbi Wallerstein, I hate this mic. Rabbi Wallerstein ripped this paper in half. Okay. We take the paper and we rip it in half. Well, not very good. So this was not very easy for the paper, as you can see, because it totally didn't rip in half and it's very scraggly on the edges. Terrible, terrible. You're not going to make it, Rebbe, in arts and crafts because this didn't work out. But in the physical world, if you take a clean piece of paper and you want to rip it in half, it's not going to rip in half. And it's not going to be exactly a straight line. Now, all the brilliant girls in here know already what I'm going to do. Now I want to rip this paper in half, and you're like, Rebbe Wallerstein, that's not going to work. What you just did is not in half, and it's terrible. So what am I going to do? I'm going to do the following. Kol Loshon, I'm sorry that you can't see this, but that's part of TorahAnytime.com can see this. Hold on. I'm going to take the piece of paper. We're going to fold it in half. Hope it works. And we're going to make an impression on the paper. Just an impression. That's all it is. I'm not cutting it with a knife. I'm not doing anything. I'm just making a new road. I'm making a new road on the paper. Not even a new road. An impression. I'm hanging out with kids who drink. I'm hanging out with kids who talk to boys. I'm hanging out with kids who smoke. I'm hanging out with kids that do the wrong thing. So I'm making an impression on the paper. Now, Rabbi Wallerstein, if you want to go down that road, hope it works. If you want to go down that road, check it out. Check it out. Look at the edges. Like I cut it with a scissor. So if the impression is made already, because you're hanging out with those kids, and there's an impression being made, then it's much easier for the Yetzer Hara to rip you in half. Much easier to rip you in half. Because there's an impression made on the paper. I did not cut the paper, the first paper and the second paper, differently. I used my hands. I didn't use scissors on one and a knife on the other. I cut them both with my hands. But the one that I made an impression on cut evenly and fast. The one I didn't make an impression on was hard to rip in half, and it didn't rip in half, and it's all over the place. So that's what it means, Avera, Guerrera, Avera. When you do a sin, when you do something, and you teach your system a new behavior, then it's going to come back later. Not for sure, but 80% for sure. Unless that person does a tshuva shalema. A tshuva shalema gets rid of the road altogether. But now let me tell you what a tshuva shalema is. I haven't gotten there yet. Many years ago, I used to go to Atlantic City. I used to go to Las Vegas. I used to gamble. What's the Avera? I had it all worked out. The Gemara says you're not allowed to gamble. There's two reasons. One, If the whole world would gamble, there'd be no shoes, no food, no one working, no one getting paid, and the world would be destroyed. Kiyam ha'olam. I'm like, I teach half a day, I got a big business, right? Make a lot of bags, I'm keeping kiyam ha'olam, so that's not my problem. Gemara says the second reason is that when you take money from someone, you're gambling, that other person doesn't want to give it to you, so you're a ganav. I'm like, well, it's Atlantic City, I'm not going privately. New Jersey says, come and play. We'll beat you anyway. So in my head, what am I doing wrong? I'm not stealing. I'm not looking at anybody. Just looking at my cards. I'm only eating kosher. The shul, Rodef Shalom in Atlantic City. Rabbi Wallstein donated. You can go there. All the Siddurim and Chumashim, Mishnayos and Gemaras. I'm a big tzaddik. Big tzaddik. Kosher, two kosher restaurants. Got them. They got the hotels to take food in from the kosher restaurants for their Jewish players so that they eat kosher. I'm mamash a tzaddik. I'm so proud of myself. This is a long time ago. And, Baruch Hashem, I did tshuva, having gambled in over 12 years, not even a quarter, not even a dime. It's a whole story with the Kava Yashar that I learned one day at Kava Yashar. And the Kava Yashar says that any money you make gambling, working on Shabbos, or anything that's usher, that money doesn't come from Hashem. The money comes from the Satan. Hashem made a deal with the Satan that whatever I have, you have, so that the fight between good and bad is equal. And Hashem gave him all this money, and that's why drug dealers are very rich. And that's why people who are Mechal Shabbos are very rich, because that money is not coming from Hashem. And the Satan wants you to be happy, because the minute you start losing money, you start coming to God. So as long as you're rich and you're affluent and you're doing well, you don't go to God. So he keeps you rich. So here I was winning all this money while I'm gambling, thinking, oh, Hashem loves me. Not realizing, no, the Satan loves me. And the Kava Yashar says that in the end of life, since the money comes from the Satan, he's your partner. And since he's your partner, because he supported you, because he's the one who gave you the money, he owns your soul when you die. So when I learned that Kava Yashar 12 years ago on a Shabbos, Hashem sent it to me. I was in a shul. I just pulled out a sefer. I said to myself, you may be stupid, but you're not that stupid. You can't win. If you win money, it's the Satan's money and you're his partner. If you lose, you're an idiot. So what do you have to gain? That was the last time I ever gambled in my life. And I walked out cold. No GA, no psychology, nothing. A Kava Yashar. I said, this is where the money's coming from. I'm not interested. Shul, Svarim, it's all baloney. It's all Yetzer Hara sold me all that stuff. Done. Finished. I walked out. And I was no small player. And I got phone calls. How did you do it? How's it possible? Can you give a speech? Can you tell us? How does a guy on that level of gambling walk out cold, straight, nothing, garnished? How could you do that? And I said, God. I can never argue with that. Oh, come on. I'm like, God. And I'm not going to talk about God to GA and all these people because that's not where they're coming from. And that was the end of it. Well, let me tell you something. There's a road in Rabbi Wallstein's soul that says gambling road. There's such a road up in the mountains also in South Forsberg. And Rabbi Wallstein put up, no enter, one way, closed, all kinds of cones, roadblocks, you name it. I will not go past Lakewood on the Garden State. I will not stop in Las Vegas to change planes to go to California. I made roadblocks like you never saw in your life. But when I was preparing this year, I thought to myself, let me ask myself something. Chas v'shalom. Chas v'shalom. Should never happen. But chas v'shalom, I lose my whole business. I lose every penny. I have no money. I owe the world. The credit card companies are calling me. The yeshivas are throwing out my kids. I can't pay tuition. I don't know which way to turn. I'm choking. I'm in that car. I'm in Atlantic City. Because I know that I can turn $500 into $50,000 in a half hour. Because that roadmap was written when I won the first time I was in Atlantic City. The Yetzer Hara was very smart. I didn't lose, I won. The worst thing is you can win. You lose, you go home, you say, I don't want to do this. I won, and I won big, and I went crazy. I said, oh my goodness. So now, Rabbi Wallstein, running on Nava, working on myself, but there's still a road in me that I know that I could sit at a table for a half an hour and I could pay all my bills. And I daven to Hashem, don't ever test me. Don't ever test me. Because I don't know what's going to happen. Because when you're desperate and you're standing at that road and the road's closed, you're going to go move those cones. So I'm telling you from my life experience. So every person in this room has to understand that whatever you step, wherever you go, that's going to be part of you. And you're going to be struggling with it. So why go there? Why create that road? Now, my friend, if he lost all his money, and I have friends that don't have money and they owe money on credit cards, and their kids are getting thrown out of yeshiva, they're not thinking of going to Atlantic. Are you crazy? I have $200 left in my name. I'm going to lose that. You're out of your mind. They're going to do something else to make that money. They're definitely not going to Atlantic City. You know why? Because that road is not there. They're searching how to make money. They're driving by. There is no such road as gambling. There is no such road as drinking. We ourselves create our own roadmap. Don't go to God and say, you did this. We create our own roadmap in life. We create our own struggles so many times because of behaviors that we taught our neshama, that we taught ourselves, and now we're fighting with those behaviors the whole time. And it's not that you can't overcome it. You have to do tshuva shlema. So I'll tell you what tshuva shlema is, and I haven't reached it. Tshuva shlema is to say that when I won that money, when I was having a great time with my friends and we were all winning, and it was in the summer and we had a great time, to say, ugh, disgusting. It makes me sick. I'm not there. Every time my friends bring up a story that happened with us, right? How we beat the house and whatever we did, I'm laughing with them. It's like, wow, you remember that? That was crazy. That's not a tshuva shlema. Your road's still open. Until the behavior that you taught yourself doesn't disgust you, it's not a tshuva shlema. And let me tell you something. I am working on it, and it is hard. And I am not there. It is hard to say I didn't have a good time and I didn't enjoy making that money. And I'm not there yet. So my road is still there. It's closed for 12 and a half years, Baruch Hashem. It's closed, but it's there. Why create, girls? Why create these roads? Avera Guerrera's Avera. What do you need it for? Next week, I'm going to explain to you why Hashem created the roads that He took us to Mitzrayim. That's also in us forever. Why did we have to go through being an Eved? Why does that have to be in the DNA of every Jew? Why did we need Mitzrayim? That's for next week. So, where you run under pressure, that's what you create. So the question is, why did the people in the Holocaust, my grandmother, and everybody's grandmother, great-grandmother, and great-grandfather, they came out of something that wasn't their road that they created. Why didn't they smoke marijuana? Why didn't that door get drunk all the time? They went through much more pain than we are. We're busy with drugs, with this, with that. Why? And the answer is, I'll tell you the answer. Because they created roads when they were kids. Their mother in Europe, when she was under pressure, when somebody was sick, she rang, Yigalach! Kindalach! Zaydi's sick! Everybody take out your tehillims! We got to daven! So their roads that they were taught as kids is that when you're in pain, where do you go? To your tehillim. So those same grandmothers, if you ever see them a whole day, they're sitting in the kitchen and they're saying tehillim. Because that's the road that their parents created, that they created. So I was thinking to myself, to do tshuva shlema is almost impossible. But if you create a superhighway, if you start to create new behaviors, and you start to daven when you're in pain, and you start to say tehillim when you're in pain, and you start to talk to Hashem when you're in pain, then you have good roads. And when you come to that road that's closed, the way you used to get rid of your pain, whether it's not eating, or chas v'sholom, somebody cutting themselves, which is a behavior that we're facing very much today, where another girl cuts herself, and it's a big joke. And then another girl says, oh, if you can do it, I can do it. And she cuts herself, and she likes how it feels. And all of a sudden, she's a cutter. And she thought that the first time she cut herself, it's not a big deal. She becomes a cutter because it's a learned behavior. And then all of a sudden, when she's in pressure, whoever doesn't know about it, you should be gazunt, you should never find out about it. But it's a very, very big problem today. Why? Because once you do it once, and it felt good, you start to do it again, and you start to do it again, and people look at it and say, what, are you crazy? This is Meshiga?
You're cutting yourself? Self-mutilation? And the answer is, yeah, because you tried it once. And whatever you felt, it's on your map now. It's on your map. A girl who talks to boys is in very big danger that when she grows up and she gets married to a man and they have a huge fight and they're not talking, there's a very big danger that she's going to go and start talking to another man, which is going to lead to all kinds of stuff. But a girl that never spoke to a boy, right? She's that religious her whole life. She never spoke. The first guy she ever spoke to was the date that she had with her husband, right? Then when she's having a fight with her husband and they're not talking and she doesn't know where to go, she's not going to pick up the phone and say, let me call my old boyfriend. Or let me speak to a man at work. Because that road is not on her map. Speaking to men, that's not on her map. It's not there. It's not a learned behavior. So when the Chachamim tell you that Al Tabe Sichem Isha, it's an interesting Mishnah. The Mishnah says Al Tabe Sichem Isha, man shouldn't talk a lot to women. And the Mishnah ends, very interesting, Shes Sofo, because at the end, Yoyresh Gehenim, you'll end up in hell. Why doesn't it just say, what does it say Sofo? Al Tabe Sichem Isha, because if you talk to a woman, you'll end up in Gehenim. What's the word sofo? That in the end, that's where you'll end up. And that's the answer. Because the person who has a learned behavior and he starts talking to women, in the end, he's going to be a good boy. He's going to be a good boy. He's going to get married. He's going to be a good boy. But there's going to be hard times. There's going to be bad times. What's he going to do? He has a learned behavior. He talks to women. So what's he going to do when he has a hard time? Shesofo, in the end, he's going to relapse. Not right away. Not when things are good. But in the end, says the Mishnah, you're going to end up in Gehenna. Because that's a learned road that you put road closed and it's very easy to move the cones. It's very simple to move the cones. But to create a new road, it's not there. You're not even looking there. And that's why the Mishnah uses the word Shesofo Yerush Gehenna. So don't talk to boy the first time. Don't go on the internet the first time. Because it's teaching you a behavior. And even if you do tshuva, it's so hard not to go back there. But one of the ways not to go back there is to create good, positive, new super highways. Torah and Tehillim and getting close to Hashem so that there's a highway next to the road that's closed. What do I need to take this dirt road with potholes in it that there's a sign in front of it closed? There's a super highway called Tehillim. I'm going to go on the super highway. And this is very important because I'm telling you, I'm talking to you about life. I'm not telling you anything that's and therefore I want to tell you something that came to me last night 5 minutes before I gave the boys share. Because, you know, I'm always questioning. I thought about this, I dealt with it, but where do you see it in the Torah? I hear the psychology, there's no one that can walk out here and say, well, Austin, you're wrong. It makes sense, we all know that. We all know that, so the behaviors you have are there. And you're in. It's a road that you created on your roadmap, on your line, on your palm, on your neshama. But I'll bring you a proof from the Torah, and this proof came 5 minutes before my share last night. There's a mitzvah in the Torah, and the mitzvah says, one of the 613 mitzvahs, that a Jew is not allowed to return to Mitzrayim. It's one of the 613 mitzvahs. You're not allowed to live in Mitzrayim. Why not? It doesn't say you're not allowed to live in Greece. It doesn't say you're not allowed to live in Rome. It doesn't say you're not allowed to live in Babylonia. It doesn't say you're not allowed to live anywhere else. The Torah has a mitzvah. You're not allowed to return to Mitzrayim. Why? Simple. Because Mitzrayim is a road on Klal Yisrael's life mat. And there's a big sign there, road closed, we got out of Mitzrayim. If you go back and you reopen that road, then all the schmutz and all the stuff that was written in Mitzrayim is all going to come back to you. Says Hashem, no pudding in the fridge. And when you're on a diet, no pudding in the fridge. Don't put yourself in a position. What do you mean? We're going to open a yeshiva and a kollel and a Beis Yaakov in Cairo. It's not the same Mitzrayim it was when we were in Mitzrayim. They're not going to make us build a Sphinx. Says the Torah, there's so much DNA. There's such a big highway that was created all those years in Mitzrayim. You can't go back and move the cones. Stay out. That's my proof to what I'm telling you from the Torah. Okay. There was someone very famous. He was called the Maggid Mikoshnitz. The Maggid Mikoshnitz was a storyteller, one of the biggest, most Kaddish Dicker people, holy people that ever lived. And you know, Baruch Hashem, Hashem sends me things. A man comes to my office on Monday from Eretz Yisrael. He says, Rabbi Wallerstein, I heard you speak. I heard you speak for girls. He doesn't know that I give a shiur to boys. He says, I want you to quote something from the Magid Mikoshnitz. It's going to help all the girls. Okay. He says, there's a sefer. You could write this down. You want to buy it? There's a sefer called Sefer Avodas Yisrael. The Sefer Avodas Yisrael was written by the Magid Mikoshnitz, and he writes many of his stories in there. And he says in this sefer that if you say the following three short stories on Shabbos HaGadol, which is not this Shabbos, it's next Shabbos, even though all the rabbis are speaking this Shabbos, because next Shabbos is Erev Pesach, but Shabbos HaGadol is not this Shabbos. Shabbos HaGadol is next Shabbos. He says in his sefer, and you can look at it, that any person that repeats these three stories to another Jew on Shabbos HaGadol, the rest of the year, niflois, miracles, and unbelievable stories will happen to that person. He says, go tell the girls these three stories and make sure that they say it over on Shabbos HaGadol. So let me tell you these three stories. It's very short. One, he says a story with the Noam Elimelech, Melizhinsk, that there was a Jew, and he used to sell whiskey, he used to sell vodka, actually, in Europe, to the non-Jewish people. And he used to sell it right before Pesach. He would sell all this vodka, and from the money, he would buy food for Pesach. Now, there was a border that he had to cross, and they had taxation, very high taxation. And if you be taxed, you make no money. So this Jew tried to smuggle this whiskey across the border to sell it to the non-Jews. And they caught him. And when they asked him, let's see your tax papers, he said, I don't have tax papers. And they took away all the whiskey. They confiscated, and he was left penniless. He went to the Noam Elimelech, and he said to the Noam Elimelech, I'm not going to have food for Pesach. They took away all my whiskey. And the Noam Elimelech said, what whiskey? He said, all my bottles of vodka. He says, ach, bottles of vodka. The person who sold you the vodka, he was a crook. It's bottles of water. He says, what? He says, yeah, it's bottles of water. Go back there and tell them that it's bottles of water. He went back, and he couldn't believe it. He went back, and he told the guards, you know all the stuff you took away? It's not vodka. It's water. They're like, yeah. He says, no, open it up. You'll see. Taste it. So they started opening up bottles. They started drinking a couple of them, and it was water. So they said, ha, Jew, look how you got fooled. That guy really ripped you off. Here, go take your wagons of water and get out of here. He comes back to the tzaddik. He comes back and to Noam Elimelech, and he says to Noam Elimelech, you know, thank you, Rebbe, for telling me this, but you didn't help me any. Because in those days, they didn't sell water. Water came from a well. He says, I'm penniless. I got beat, and I'm penniless. I have no money. He says, go taste it. He goes back, opens the wagon, drinks it, and it's vodka. It's a story, Noam Elimelech. You'll see it in the Sefer. He sells the vodka, and he has the best Pesach he ever had in his life. He made so much money, he did so well. It's one of the maifsim known from Noam Elimelech. You don't believe it, you do believe it. It doesn't make a difference. If the Magid Mikoshnitz said it, it's true. This was not stam a person. This was a big, big tzaddik. Story number one you need to say over next Shabbos. Story number two, there was a paritz, like the landowner, and there was a little village, and right before Pesach, he knew that the Jews had no money. So one of the Jews in the city, he called over, the paritz called over this Jew, and he said, listen, for the next week, I want you to work for me, and every day, 10 hours, 12 hours, 15 hours, and I'm going to pay you, he's going to pay him nothing, very, very little. He's going to use them, because he knew that the Jews needed a little money to buy matzah. This man said, I'm not going to start this, because if I take this job, then he's going to do this to all the Jews, right? And he said, I'm not taking the job, I'm not interested. And he said, the paritz said, what do you mean you're not interested? You're going to starve, you're not going to have any money. So the Jew said, I'd rather starve. I'm not working 20 hours for nothing. So the paritz said, really? So then you're not going to have any money, your children are not going to have any food? I'm going to teach you a lesson. And this Jew turned around and says, what do you think? Money comes from you? Money comes from God. If Hashem wants me to have money, I don't need a job from you. He turned around and he walked away. Okay. Now this paritz was a very rich man, and he was one of the only guys in Europe who owned a monkey. He had a monkey, a pet, a monkey. This was brought down in the sefer. And he went down to his treasury. He was a very greedy guy. He used to every week go down to his treasury and look at his gold and his silver. And he would like, you know, he'd shine it and clean it. And the monkey thought that this guy, right, was spitting out jewels. Because He saw it, or he bit it, whatever it is. He saw it in the parrot's mouth, whatever it was. So when the parrots left the room to go back upstairs, the monkey stayed, and he started eating all the jewelry and all the gold, because he thought that's what his master did. And he started popping all this gold and jewelry down his mouth. Of course, a monkey can't handle that, and he died. Now, the parrots didn't come down for another week. He comes into the room, he opens it up, and it stinks. Because this monkey was dead already for a week, and it was totally deteriorated. It was disgusting. And he turns around, and he says to his workers, he says, you know, the Jew has nothing to eat for Pesach. We'll give him something to eat. And he says, take the monkey and throw it on his front lawn, and let him, and knock on the door and tell him he can eat the monkey for Pesach instead of matzah. So they take this monkey, and they think it's very funny, and they throw it on the lawn. And they leave, and they tell the Jew, you can eat the monkey. Enjoy your Pesach. Nope. He goes to the thing. He sees a dead monkey. He says, okay, listen, we can't leave it over here. We got to bury it. He picks it up. The belly opens up, and all these diamonds and jewels come out. He says, unbelievable. Look at our Kadosh Baruch Hu. He sends me a monkey from Shemayim, right? And I have all these jewels. So he sells the jewels. He has the most amazing Pesach you could imagine, millions of dollars. He invites the whole village. The whole village is coming to this man's house. They got stuff on that Pesach sale. They buy. It's amazing. The parrot says to his friends, okay, let's go see what the Jew's doing. He has no money. Maybe he's eating the monkey. You know, in somewhere, I don't know, South Africa, they eat monkey brains, whatever. Right? So maybe he's eating the monkey brains. Let's see what's going on. Monkey brains for Pesach, you know? Nope. So they're not kosher. Someone's going to say, you allowed to eat them? No, they're not kosher. So the parrot takes a look, and he sees that this Jew is eating, and he's rich, and whatever it is. He comes running into the house. He says, where'd you get all this money from? He says, it's unbelievable. God sent me a monkey, right? And it was full of jewels. And the parrot realizes that it was his monkey, because he's the one who said, throw it on the lawn. And he turns to the Jew, and he says, the God of Yisrael is the true God. Story number two. The God of Yisrael is the true God. He realized he was trying to make fun of him. And that's how Hashem made that this Jew was rich. He said, I realize that God of the Jews is a real God. Okay, story number two. Story number three. Story number three was, there was a king. This is the three stories that he says. There was a king who had a diamond ring, and he was very attached to his diamond ring. It was worth a lot of money. And he put out a thing that whoever will find it for him, whoever will look for him, he'll pay him $10,000 up front. So this Jewish guy came, and he said, I'll look for it, I'll find it, and he gave him $10,000. Meanwhile, this non-Jewish person was standing there, and he was very jealous of the Jewish person, and he said to the king, listen, I know this guy, he's lazy, he took your money, he's going to use it, and he'll never find it, and he'll never look for it. The king says, I don't believe you. Why are you saying that? He says, you'll see, we'll wait 3 days, and you'll see. 3 days later was Pesach. He took, now this guy was, I guess it was in a Spanish kingdom, whatever, his name was Diano. It's a famous story. And Diano told the king, Pesach night, you want to see if the Jew is looking? Let's go now and see what the Jew is doing. So they come to the window, and they see, through the window, this Jewish guy. He's sitting at the table. His whole family is there. They're drinking wine. They're eating. This Diano turns to the king, says, yeah, you see what he did with the money? He's sitting here with his whole family, busy talking. He's not looking for anything. So the king says, let's just see what's going on. Let's listen. So where are they up to? This is the Magen Mikashnitz. So where are they up to? They're up to Dayenu. So they're going around the table, and each person at the table is saying, Elu Atziyah, everyone's screaming, Dayenu! Right? And they go through the whole Dayenu, each one is screaming, Dayenu! And the king turns to Diano and says, why are they screaming your name? So Diano says, I don't know. So the king turns to another guy, his guard next to him, and he says, do you understand Hebrew at all? He says, not really, but a little bit. You don't want to tell the king you don't understand anything. He says, what's going on in there? He says, it seems to me that each person asks who stole the king's ring, and everyone screams, Diano. But Diano stole the king's ring. Magi Mikoshnitz. So when Diano hears this, he starts to panic, and he turns to the king, and he says, I don't know how this Jew knows this, but it's true. I'm the one who took your ring. Please don't kill me. Magi Mikoshnitz, these three stories, make sure you say next week to somebody in your house, because the Maggid says that if you say these three stories, you will see Nisim Niflon this year. So this man came to tell you these three stories. Okay, I want to end
on a, probably the most amazing story I've ever heard in my life. I'm going to repeat to you tonight. And I've heard a lot of stories and I've said thousands of stories, but you've never heard anything like this. But before I say this story, I just want to tell you one little thing. It's brought down in Svarim Kedoshim, in very holy Svarim, that Pesach, we'll talk more about it next week in Ritz Hashem, but that Pesach is a kapara for the Avera of selling Yosef HaTzadik. And I'm going to do a lot more research on this because I really want to speak about this next week. But I just want to tell you something unbelievable. How is Pesach forgiveness for Yosef HaTzadik? You ready for this? Listen carefully. They sold Yosef. And what did they do? The first thing they did is they sat down and they ate bread. I just want to read it to you from inside. Anyway, the pasuk says, if you look it up, I don't have it marked off exactly where it says it, that after they sold him, the first thing they did is they sat down and they had bread, so we're not going to have bread. That's the first kapara. The next thing they did, this is amazing. This is based on a very big question. The question is, I'm sure you've all heard as girls growing up, the stories of the blood libels, where they would kill a non-Jewish kid, fill up a bottle of blood, say that the Jews use blood in their matzahs and in their wine, and then the Cossacks and all these people, they would kill mamish cities. Pesach was the scariest time of the Jews the whole year. You should know that. And the Goyim was created by the Maharal because he needed someone to run around to make sure that the Goyim weren't doing this. But many Jews died, burnt at the stake because the Goyim, it's called Alilas Dam. The Goyim would say that we use blood of their children in our matzahs. Even last year, that Michiganer from Iran, that guy, Amma Jemadal, whatever his name is, said that also. He said that the Jews still use blood. They still believe such a thing. And the question is, why Pesach? Shavuos, Sukkot, Purim. Say that we drink Purim. Why Pesach? Why did they pick on Pesach? And the answer is, listen carefully. What did the brothers do? Vayikhu es hakisaynes Yosef. They took the kisaynes pasim of Yosef, his jacket. Vayishchateu si'ir izim. And they shechted, they killed a si'ir izim, a goat. Vayitbelu es hakisaynes badam. And they dipped the kisaynes in blood. They brought it to their father, and their father said, oh my goodness, Taraf, Taraf Yosef, it's his blood. He was ripped. So what did they do? They took animal blood, and they made believe it's human blood. So the Alilas Dam, the Satan says, because the Jews took, the brothers took animal blood and said it's human blood, and it wasn't human blood, so now the Goyim have the power to say the same thing, that it's human blood when it's not human blood. Mida keneged mida. Amazing. Mind-boggling. Mida keneged mida, that the brothers said, this blood is human blood and it wasn't human blood? So the Goyim have a right to say that it's human blood when it's wine, when it's not really human blood. And we are suffering, and the Jews suffered all the Alilas Dam because of what they did. So we have to fix it. So what do? We bring a Korban Pesach. And we dip twice by the Seder. Because when they left Mitzrayim, the thing that they did when they left Mitzrayim that we don't do anymore is they took the blood of the Korban Pesach, made from the same animal that they used, the blood on the Kesayinus Pasim, they dipped the blood and they put it on their mashkof and on their mezuzos. They dipped the blood of the animal, like they did with Yosef's jacket, and they put it on the mashkof to forgive them for what they did. And therefore, when we sit by a Seder, we do two dippings. We do one to remember the dipping of the blood of his jacket, and we do the other one to remember the blood that was machaper, that fixed it, the blood that the Jews did in Mitzrayim, that they dipped it on the doors. And there's a lot of connections between Mechiras Yosef and this, and why there are blood libels. But I have to tell you, there's a guy, and I'm saying it publicly, there's a guy on my floor, his name is Sender Ashkenazi and his father. They live in Borough Park. The very big Bali Tzedakah. And every year, they give out in Israel, it's probably about $5-6 million worth, they give out 60,000 pairs of shoes for Pesach. It's amazing. It takes them a week. They have all the poor people's names, family of nine. Each kid gets a Shabbos pair and a weekday pair with beautiful shoes. The parents have to send in the size. They size them. It's amazing. 60,000 pairs of shoes. So I went into him on Monday and I said, why? Everybody's taking $4-5 million and buying matzah, kimcha de pischa. Why are you buying shoes for Pesach? Buy shoes Shavuos. It's a nice time, right? Buy shoes Sukkot. They're going back to school, September. He said, I don't know. It started many years ago and that's what we do. And I said, Sender, I want to tell you something. I told it to him this week. I'll tell you why you do a Pesach. Because what did they sell Yosef for?
Shoes.
They didn't take. They didn't want it. The money wasn't Kaddish. The money was unholy. They got the money from selling their brother, so they didn't know what to do. So Chazal says they went ahead and they bought shoes because shoes are chol. I said, Sender, you know why you give shoes out every Pesach? 60,000 pairs to be machaper on the shoes that the brothers got for selling Yosef. And we know that it's very connected to the Holocaust. It's called the Room of Shoes. That you go and you can see how the thing that they kept from the Jews were their shoes. There's a very big connection between Mechiras Yosef and the Holocaust also.
And
Asara Rugamalchus, he had shoes in the room, he filled up the room with shoes, whatever it is. So Pesach is a tikkun on the selling of Yosef. And Mirza Hashem, next week we're going to talk all about the matzah and the wine and building the human body. Now I'm going to tell you the story. And you must stay here for the story and you must be very awake. Because this is the greatest story I've ever heard in my life. I know I've said that before, but this one just took over everyone. Listen to this story. Amazing. So the question is, why is Marar, which is the bitter, in the middle of your Seder plate? The middle of your Seder plate is Marar. That's the middle, that's the center, that's the main thing of Pesach. Put the Korban Pesach in the middle. Put the matzah in the middle. In the middle is the Marar. To teach us that what took us out of Mitzrayim? Our suffering. The maror, the suffering of Mitzrayim, that's what got us out of Mitzrayim. Because had we been having a good time, we wouldn't have left. Sort of on the same basis of Baruch Haman, that pain brings a person closer to Hashem. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Hashem is Rachamim, Elokeinu is Din. Hashem and Elokeinu, Din and Rachamim is one. Because both of them lead to getting closer to Hashem. For instance, in pain, you cry. So the maror is the center of getting us out of Mitzrayim, and we'll talk about that next week. Listen to this story. There was a blood libel in Poland. It wasn't true, and they took these two brothers, and without even a court case, they threw them into a deep, deep jail, a very small room, with a bunch of goyim for life. And they throw them into this room, and the two of them, one of them is laying on the floor and he's crying his eyes out. His mom is crying. His brother walks over to him and says, Chaim, you have to be makabel, you have to accept pain the same way you accept happiness. You can't do this. This is not the way to serve Hashem. It's Bashar. Hashem wants us to be in jail for life. We have to accept it. You shouldn't be crying like this. You're a Baal Emuna. You believe in Hashem. Why are you crying like this? And his brother turned to him and said, I am not crying because of the pain. I am crying that we're stuck in this little teeny room. And in the corner of this room was a pail. And in the pail is where everybody went to the bathroom. There was no toilet. So everyone who had to go to the bathroom made in the pail. He said, brother, you know the halacha. You're not allowed to pray within 8 feet of Zevel. Right? I don't know a nice way to say it, so I'll say it in Hebrew. Of Zebel, of the stuff that's in the toilet. And we're in a room that's 8x8, which means we'll never ever be able to daven to Hashem. We'll never be able to say Tehillim. We'll never be able to learn. We'll never be able to bench, because you're not allowed to say Hebrew words. You're not allowed to daven. You're not allowed to even think Torah if you're within 8 feet of Zebel. He said, he told his brother, how could you not be crying? We're stuck in the cell for life. No connection to Hashem. And his brother looked at him, the one that wasn't crying, and said, you're making a big mistake. We're the only ones in the world that are able to keep this halacha. Everybody else, if there's a toilet or zevel, they go to the next room. They get rid of the zevel. They leave and they go daven.
We are the only two Jews on the whole world that are keeping the halacha that if there's zevah within 8 feet, you can't daven. We're so lucky. Nobody else can do this. We should dance. And he says, you're right. You're right. We're able to keep a halacha nobody else is able to keep. So the brother that was crying picks up the pail and he starts to dance. And he starts to dance. And I have to show you this. Mike or no Mike. He takes the pail of whatever. Stinks pretty bad, right? And he starts to dance in the middle of the room. Baruch Hashem! I can't daven. I can't bench. I can't learn. I am keeping the halacha that it says you can't do all this. And the goyim in the room are looking around and they're saying, they're nuts. You got two Jews with a pail of zevel dancing in the middle of the room, singing like maniacs. And the goyim who don't know anything about Judaism are thinking to themselves, ah, we knew it was a crazy religion. They serve their God with zevel. There was such an avodah zarah called Baal Pa'ar, and that's how they served, by defecating. And that's what they thought. So, you got these two Jews, if you could picture this, in a jail cell in Poland, surrounded by goyim, dancing with a pot, with a garbage can full of stuff. And the goyim see this, and they say, let's dance with them. All of a sudden, you got a jail cell with two Jews in the middle, like Simchas Torah would say for Torah. They're dancing, this is what I would set over. They're dancing as much as a tzaddik dancer would say for Torah, they're dancing with this pail of stuff. We can keep the mitzvah that you're not allowed to daven when you have this within 8 amos, within 8 feet, within 4 amos. And the goyim are dancing with them, and their mamash flying. The guy, the jail, the guard, who had a sinner for Jews, who hated Jews, opens the door. This is craziness. He's supposed to be depressed and crying, and the whole room, it's Simchas Torah by the goyim too. The whole room is dancing, and he sees what they're dancing with. So he turns to me and says, why are they dancing with the latrine? Why are they dancing with the pale foot? What's going on over here? And he says, you don't know? The Jews serve God with stuff. And the God, who was an anti-Semite, who hated Jews, said, no, you ridiculous story. Who hated Jews, said, give me that pail right now. And he grabbed it out of the Jew's hand, and he ran outside, and he dumped everything out, and he washed the pail that there wasn't one drop of stuff left. Clean as can be. Ran back into the room, shoved it into the Jew's hand, and says, ha! Now you have nothing to give your God. And he turned to the goyim, this guard, this is not a joke. And he turned to the goyim, and the guard said, listen to me carefully. Anybody who goes to the bathroom in that pail, you have 10 seconds to get that pail to the door. It has to be cleaned out immediately. These Jews are never getting a chance to do this again. And they put the pail down. Listen, girls. And they put the pail down, and it's absolutely squeaky clean. There's nothing in it. It's washed out. And one brother looks at the other brother and he grabs him and he says, now we can pray. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Listen, Yisrael. Hashem, which is Yud Kei Vav Kei Rachamim, Elokeinu, which is Din, saying davening, which is Yud Kei Vav Kei, or Din that you can't daven. Hashem Echad. It's all one. It's all rachamim. It's all love. Not being able to daven, you can serve Hashem like that. Being able to daven, you can serve Hashem like that. Eating maror on Pesach, you can serve Hashem like that. Eating charoses, the opposite, you can serve Hashem like that. Eating matzah, which reminds you how broken and we're ani and we're not rising and we're depressed, you can serve Hashem like that. Yayin, which represents kingdom, which represents godless, you can serve Hashem like that. In any situation that a Jew is, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Good night.